He's the author of over 20 books and speaking in over 100 cities a year. William Feder is a best-selling author and nationally known speaker. And I asked him the question, does anybody call you America's historian yet? And he said, oh, there's a lot better. I just do what I do. But nobody quite does it like William Feder. One of the greatest storytellers we've seen is American Minute. AmericanMinute.com is fantastic. And just a pleasure to talk to him on the eve of Thanksgiving, so to speak. William Feder, welcome back to the Power Hour.
It's great to be with you.
Now, you've written a lot of books. We've talked about several of them. You have a new book, I think, that fits with this discussion. We want to definitely get to Thanksgiving. The name of it is The Treacherous World of the 16th Century and How the Pilgrims Escaped It. Why did you write this book? Let's go back in history and start there and what led up to, you know, basically America. But let's start there.
Well, this is what I call the prequel to America's freedom. So, you know, they have the Star Wars, and they come out with a prequel. So this has happened before. And so this goes through before the pilgrims came over. We look at Europe, and you had the Muslims surrounding Vienna, Austria. Sultan Suleiman the Magnificent with 100,000 Turks. And, you know, they send a message to King Leopold saying, await us in your residence so we may decapitate you. And so people forget that all of North Africa used to be Christian. There were 250 Catholic dioceses along North Africa in the 7th century. Boom, all wiped out by the Umayyad Muslims. The Christians at that time had taught themselves their version of separation of church and state. It was called piety or pietism, where if you're really a Christian, you'll give away all your money and live in a cave. And so it was all this me-focused salvation that abandoned any responsibility to pass it on to your kids. And so the Muslims conquered North Africa. People forget Egypt used to be completely Christian, evangelized by Mark, that wrote the gospel, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, until the Muslim leader Amir ibn Alas conquers Egypt. Syria was completely Christian for 6 centuries, evangelized by the Apostle Paul. The name Christian was first used in Syria until Caliph Umar conquers it. And then all of Turkey used to be Christian. It was the Byzantine Christian Empire. All 7 churches mentioned in the book of Revelation, and they were all wiped out by the Ottoman Turks and the Seljuk Turks. And so finally the Turks are surrounding Vienna, Austria, and the Holy Roman Emperor, his name is Charles V. Now, you think, what's a Holy Roman Emperor? So for 1,000 years since Charlemagne, you had kings in Europe, and then all the different kings would sort of vote to have one of them be this Holy Roman Emperor who had a double duty of protecting Christendom. And so the King of Spain in the 1500s had to be the King of Spain, but also he was the protector. And so he had to fight the Muslim Turks on all these different fronts. And so then the Reformation starts in 1517, Martin Luther. And Charles V is the young King of Spain and Holy Roman Emperor. And he's got this trial. He's got a bunch of monks on one side saying one thing and this one lone monk on the other side. He called it an argument among monks. And so he basically says, I'm going with the many. Sorry, Martin Luther. But Martin Luther's swept away, hidden in a castle, translates the Bible into German. And some German princes were looking for an opportunity to break away from Rome. And they tell their kingdom, we're all now Lutheran. And so Europe begins to break up. And so Charles V, the Holy Roman Emperor, is now faced with 2 problems. The internal problem of the Reformation, the external problem of the Muslims invading and surrounding Vienna, Austria, and taking over the Mediterranean. And so Charles V, after a couple of decades of trying to stop the Islamic invasion, does a deal with the Protestants. It's called the Peace of Augsburg of 1555. It is the first treaty ever to recognize Protestants. And there's a little Latin phrase in this treaty that had enormous repercussions. The phrase was, tuius regio, ius religio, which means, whose is the reign, is the religion. In other words, look, Protestant king, believe whatever you want in your kingdom. Let's just work together against these Muslims who are invading Europe because they sort of want to kill us all. Well, it worked. It stopped the invasion. But in the next century, different kings decided to believe different things. And so England was Anglican, Scotland was Presbyterian, Holland was Dutch Reformed, Northern Germany and Sweden were Lutheran, Switzerland Calvinist, and of course Italy, Spain, France, Austria, Poland stayed Catholic. But it was this concept, it was one Christian denomination per country. So we go from one Christian denomination per continent, right, Catholic, now it's one Christian denomination per country. So we're sort of dividing up the pie. And but if you don't believe the way your king did, it's considered treason. And so we focus on England. England had the king, Henry VIII, and he is married to the daughter of the King of Spain. You know how these kings would intermarry. But after 18 years, this daughter, her name's Catherine of Aragon, she does not have a son. So Henry decides to divorce her. The Pope won't recognize the divorce because the King of Spain's army did invade Rome and imprison the Pope for 6 months. So the Pope's not in any hurry to get on the wrong side of Spain. So the Pope says no to the divorce. Henry VIII says, you know what? I'm just going to declare myself my own Pope. He starts the Church of England, puts himself on as the head, goes on to have six wives, and their fates were divorce, beheaded, died, divorce, beheaded, survived. So Henry VIII was not a really nice guy to be married to. Ended up being around 400 pounds. He only ate meat. He thought vegetables and fruit were sissy food. So he's eating pork and beef and chicken and turkey. And he's just getting bigger, bigger, gets gout in his leg, and then he dies. But anyway, after he divorces his first wife, his advisors come to him and they say, King, if you're really serious about breaking from Rome, you need to stop using that Latin Bible. You need to get yourself an English Bible. The German princes have Martin Luther's German Bible that helped them to break away from Rome. You need an English Bible. So it's interesting. Just a couple years earlier, Henry VIII had William Tyndale burnt at the stake for translating the Bible into English. But now, it's a couple years later, he wants to break from Rome. He needs an English Bible. William Tyndale's last words were, Lord, open the King of England's eyes. So here they basically take William Tyndale's work, they redo it, they call it the Great Bible, and Henry has it printed en masse and put in every single church in England. It's called a chained Bible because they would chain it to the pulpit. It was so valuable. But they would sort of rent out time. This is the first time ever that the people in England could read the scriptures in their own language. I mean, there were some scholarly translations, but this is where the common people had access to the Bible. And something unexpected happened. People began to read it and began to compare what's in this Bible to this king divorcing and beheading his wives. And so a group starts that wants to purify the Church of England. They are nicknamed the Puritans. Well, the king obviously does not think he needs purifying, so he persecutes the Puritans. There's another group that said it's beyond hope of wanting to purify the Church of England. We are going to separate ourselves. They call themselves separatists. We call them pilgrims. And so they would meet in secret barns and basements by candlelight, sort of like the illegal house churches in China. They would get raided. They'd be brought before, you know, the government, whipped and beaten. They would even drag them before the Star Chamber. So the king's attitude was, yes, you can read the Bible in your own language, but no, you still can't believe what you want. You got to believe what I tell you to want. And so the king passes the Act of Uniformity in prayer. And so you don't just make up prayers. You read the approved prayers out of the book. A wedding, funeral, a baptism, whatever it is, you just open it up to the page and read it. And if you have five people meeting in your home and you are talking religion without approval of the king, you're all criminals. They'll bust into your house and arrest everybody like they're doing in China. They passed a 5-mile act. If you're caught preaching within 5 miles of a town without approval of the government, you're a criminal. And the Star Chamber, they'll twist your arm. And there's secret hearings, sort of like what's going on in Washington, D.C., these secret hearings. And you can't meet your accuser. You can't have an attorney. They'll twist your arm. They'll brand you on the face as a heretic, even cut off your ear or cut your nose in half, or put you in the pillory in the middle of town with your arms and legs in shackles. And so this was the reason that the separatists began to want to flee. One separatist leader, he ended up being one of the founders of the Baptist faith in England, Thomas Helwys. He dies in the Newgate prison. He's a dissenter. And he basically says, if the king can stand there on the day of judgment and answer for your conscience, fine, believe whatever the king tells you to believe. But if the king is not going to be there on the day of judgment. You are accountable to God for your own conscience. Anyway, excuse me.
Wow.
So the pilgrims decided to flee. And they, a group of them, sorry, I got a little frog in my throat here.
Hey, that's okay. Get some water. Take a second. I'm struck.
Well, I've been,
I'm struck by a couple things. Let me ask you a quick. Go ahead and clear your throat or whatever you need to do. I'm struck by, yesterday we talked about George Whitefield and kind of how revolutionary this idea that God's intimately connected with you when he went to the colonies, and the colonies just, you know, this is like the greatest thing ever. And the king doesn't have an exclusive right to speak to God. What you're saying, you know, 100 years or so before that, or 150, I guess, before George Whitefield, some man just said, you have a right to believe your conscience. And it's like, you're going to jail and we're going to kill you. My God, oh, you can't say anything like that. I'm just struck by this.
Yes, yes. Later, there's William Penn, and he spends 8 months in the Newgate prison himself. Oh, he's in the Tower of London. And he said, force makes hypocrites. 'Tis persuasion only that makes converts. And so It begins this concept of conscience, that your worship of God is only valuable to God if it is freely given, not just raising your hand and saying, okay, whatever the king says, I'll just go with it. I don't understand it, but I'm fine with it. You know? And so this is what gives birth to the whole idea of evangelism. I mean, if you happen to believe, if everybody has to believe what the king says, why have an evangelistic meeting? But once you give birth to this concept of conscience, then people have a choice as to whether or not they're going to surrender their heart to the Lord. And so that's what gave birth to these revival preachers. First, it was a revival movement inside of the Anglican Church by the Wesleys, but then it breaks out with the George Whitefield that you mentioned. But anyway, back to the pilgrims. So a group of pilgrim separatists sell their property, arrange to get passage on a ship in London over to Holland right before the ship takes off. The captain turns them over to the authorities and then robs them, and they're put in jail as heretics, right? Another group of these pilgrim separatists arrange for a Dutch ship to pick him up off the coast, and they have their rowboats, and they're going to row out. Well, the pilgrims arrive a day early. They're in their rowboats, and the sea is rough, and the women and the children, little kids are getting sick. They're waiting, and the wives say, look, can we wait on land? And they say, okay. And then the Dutch ship comes. The men row out, put their stuff on the ship, and someone had snitched. The British come over the hill, capture the women and children. And the Dutch captain says, I don't have any army to wage a war. We're out of here. He pulls anchor and sails away with the men. And these women are watching their men sail away for 2 years. They pass those women and children from one court in England to another. They're in prison and jail, one court, another.
Wow.
Finally, a judge says, you didn't do anything wrong. Go home. They go, duh, we sold our homes. And then just to get them out of their hair, they put them on a boat, send them over to Holland. They finally find out where their husbands are at. So there's a happy ending to that chapter. But these pilgrims are in Holland for 12 years. Spain threatens to attack Holland. It was an 80-year war of independence for Holland to break away from Spain. And Holland had seven United Provinces, and they had a little give and take when it came to religion, and so that's why the pilgrims wanted to go over there. So the pilgrims then decide, well, we don't want to be conquered by Spain. Let's go to the New World. They originally think of going to Guyana in South America. They hear of the perpetual spring and the nice warm weather, but then someone tells them about what the Spanish do to other country settlements. So Jacksonville, Florida, 1565, had a Fort Caroline settlement of a bunch of Protestants from France. They were called Huguenots. Spanish found out about it, butchered all the men, took the women and children away. And so these pilgrims say, let's not go to Guyana. It's too close to the Spanish main. That's the area of the Caribbean controlled by Spain. So the pilgrims decide to go to Jamestown, started about a dozen years earlier. It was a king-controlled colony, but they thought, we'll be 3,000 miles away, and the king won't notice us. So they get on the boat, and it starts leaking. They have to go back. re-caulk it because it's a wooden boat with beams, and they would, you know, shove greasy cloths in between the wooden beams. But then, wow, when the sail, the wind blows, the wind, you know, tilts the ship over. Well, it compresses the wooden beams on one side, but Seth opens them up on the other. There's leaks, so they got to take the boat back. They re-caulk it. It still leaks. They swap it out,
wow,
for the Mayflower. They're wasting a lot of time eating through their food. But now they're coming across the Atlantic in the winter. It's stormy. They are 102 of them. They're in a 4-foot high space for 66 days, 3,000 mile journey. One dies, another's born, and they get to America, and they're 500 miles away from Jamestown. And how am I doing time wise?
You're doing fantastic. I'll stop. You got about 8 minutes for the break, so you're doing great.
Okay, and so the pilgrims decide to. They say, well, let's try to go to Jamestown. Well, off the coast of Cape Cod, it's really shallow, about a mile out, and 3,000 ships have sunk on that stretch of the coast. And so the pilgrims almost get stuck on a sandbar and smashed to pieces in the violent waves. The captain gets free, goes back to Plymouth Rock, says, it is too dangerous to do any more sailing. Everyone off the boat. And the pilgrims are like, it's November 20th, you know, there's no king appointed person on the boat. And so this is interesting. They decide to give themselves the authority to start a government. And that is profound. And it's a polarity change in the flow of power. Instead of top-down rule by kings, the whole world is ruled by Chinese emperors, Indian maharajas, Russian czars, kings of Spain, France, Austria, African chieftains, you know, King Kamehameha's, and, you know, Japanese emperors. The whole world is ruled by kings through their underlings, and there's no king-appointed person on the pilgrim boat, but yet the captain is saying, get off. And so they do something unique. They give themselves the authority to start a government. And it's actually a polarity change in the flow of power. Instead of top down, it's bottom up. In the womb of this little Mayflower is this DNA change. And it's the beginning of self-government. That's why we look back to the pilgrims as the quote-unquote founders, because they came up with this model of self-government. And where did they get this idea? From their pastor, John Robinson. He was not a king-appointed Anglican pastor. He was he's considered one of the founders of the Congregationalist Church, which is a church model where everybody in the congregation's involved, right? Taking care of the kids in the nursery and the daycare and the junior high and, you know, adult Sunday school. And then you become a deacon. And it's this bottom-up form of government. And then when you have tough decisions, everyone fasts and prays and votes. It's the difference between a dead pyramid rule from the top down and a living tree where every root and every tiny capillary root sucks in nutrients to help keep this thing alive. Every single citizen participates in this bottom-up form of government working. So they basically took their church model of government and they made it their community model of government. And then the pilgrims became the model for the other New England colonies. And you had a pastor. Go ahead.
Let me pause you here. We got about, I don't know, 6 or 7 minutes. Let me make a couple comments and get your thoughts. I'm struck by two things listening to you. One, how much tyranny was done in the name of religion. I mean, I'm just never surprised by, in the name of God, how many people were oppressed and killed and what have you. It just never ceases to amaze me. And the idea, comparing America to the old world, Europe, what America became, Thomas Jefferson, these thoughts, George Whitefield, whatever, the independence, the reason, the morality. In the old world, they had religion, they believed in God, but yet they were so tyrannical. You know, it's not the idea, well, just because we believe in God, then we're free. No, what America did was profound beyond profound. The second thing that strikes me about everything, well, really the first thing that strikes me is your ability to tell a story, which is fantastic. The next thing that strikes me is you can see the fingerprints of some divine providence and divine guidance through all, you know, King Henry VIII was really a scoundrel, but you can see how God was creating seeds that then would go to America by his action, because he wanted the divorce and him killing his wives, and how, you know, this tragedy with the boat led to this, how through the fingerprints of God, through these supposed tragedies of history, we are birthed, miraculous events occurred. That's what strikes me.
Well, and the one story, and again, all of this is in the book, The Treacherous World of the 16th Century and How the Pilgrims Escaped It. If anyone's interested, my website's AmericanMinute.com. But the story is Squanto. This is fascinating. So about the same time the Pilgrims flee England to Holland, and they're there for 12 years, about that same time, you had some unscrupulous European, you know, boats go along the coast of America and lure Indians on board, put them in chains, take them back to Spain, sell them into slavery. So a little background. You got Columbus discovering America. You have Spain has a monopoly on the New World for 100 years. And other countries try to do settlements. Spain wipes them out. Spain's taking the gold from the New World, the Incas, and they're using it to fit out their navy to fight the Muslims to keep them from taking over Europe. And then you have the French, Dutch, and the English robbing the Spanish ships of gold. And so they're like pirates. And so they're not really scrupulous Puritans and Pilgrims. They're sort of a rough and tough crowd. You know, they found Jamaica and Port Royal, and it was like they called the sodomy of the New World because of the pirates and so forth. But so these Pilgrims, they land on this seaboard. Well, a couple years, this dozen years before, one of the Indians that's captured is named Squanto. And he's taken to Spain, sold into slavery, but he's freed by some monks. And we assume that he was introduced to Christianity. But then he hitchhikes his way across Europe to London. And now this American Indian is in London, learns how to speak English, gets jobs. He's working. And I mean, just imagine that he's living there for years, for like a dozen years. And then he finds a business that is doing trading with Newfoundland and fishing and so forth. And so he gets to go over to Newfoundland, and now he's like an interpreter. And then he finally gets a ship to drop him off at Cape Cod, only to find his what happened. Mm-hmm. William Bradford said that a few years earlier, a French ship was shipwrecked at Cape Cod, and the sailors got ashore, but the Indians never left watching them and dogging them till they got the advantage and killed them all but three or four, who they sent from one sachem chief to another, making sport with them, using them worse than slaves. Well, evidently one of those French fishermen must have had some illness. The Indians did not have immunity. It wiped out the entire tribe. So in a sense, had Squanto not been kidnapped, he most certainly would have died. But here he is. He's depressed. He goes off to live with the Wampanoag tribe. And this is just a few months before the Pilgrims land. The Pilgrims land at his spot, and since it was so thorough of a wiping out of the other tribe, no other Indian tribe claimed that land. It was sort of a no man's land. So the Pilgrims landed on one spot that was more or less uninhabited. But half of the Pilgrims died the first winter. And the next spring in March, the Squanto comes into the camp. And you can just imagine the scene. Here he is with his leather, you know, loincloth and his feathers in his hair. And he goes, "Oh, you guys from London? Yeah, I used to live there." "Oh, yeah, down at Wharf Street. Oh, yeah, St. Paul's Chapel. I know, yeah." Yeah. And he goes, and then he says, "Here, I grew up here. I know this area like the back of my hand. Over the hill, there's a spring over there." And William Bradford says that Squanto was a special instrument sent of God for their good beyond their expectation. He showed them how to catch fish. The Pilgrim said, "We tried." He goes, "No, they're salmon. They spawn in April. This river will be packed. You'll just put nets in there and harvest them." And then he showed them how to plant corn. They said, "We tried." He goes, "No, you have to take a dead fish, put it down, and then put the kernel on there and guard it for a couple of weeks to keep the wolves away. The dead fish fertilizes the soil, and you have a nice stalk of corn." He taught them how to put the corn in a pot, shake it over a fire, and make popcorn, right? That came from the American Indians. Wow. Taught them how to go down a riverbank, squeegee in the mud, and catch eels. And then William Bradford says, neither was there a man among them who had even seen a beaver skin until instructed by Squanto. And it took 40 years worth of beaver skins to pay off their debt to the investors that paid for their boat ride. We never ask ourselves. But then he finally dies, and a couple years later, and Squanto begs Governor Bradford to pray for him that he would go to the Englishman's God in heaven. But Squanto put him on good terms with the other Indian tribes, and that's how they had that first Thanksgiving.
Stay tuned. Wow, more with William Bradford on the other side. This is your country, ladies and gentlemen. Fantastic. AmericanMinute.com, thepowerhour.com. We'll be right back.
Hi, this is Jay at the Power Mall. I thought I would discuss an item that's very valuable to my personal health and well-being. That product is called Curcumin X4000. Its potent antioxidant properties have been shown to decrease swelling and allow us to enjoy our golden years. Take control over your health today, guys. Order Curcumin by calling 877-817-9829 or order at thepowermall.com. That's thepowermall.com. As you all know, everything begins with an idea. Ideas have helped shape the very world we live in. ThePowerMall.com began as an idea, allowing entrepreneurs and small business owners like yourself the opportunity to not only survive, but thrive in an era where corporations dominate. ThePowerMall.com is a small family-owned business who has partnered with companies you've come to rely on and trust over the years, like Strauss Heart Drops, North American Urban Spice, Miracle 2 Soaps, Vitamir, Humana Food Storage, to name just a few. Fight back against large corporations when you buy from thepowermall.com. Need to speak to a real person? Call Jay at thepowermall.com and receive superior customer service. Call 1-877-817-9829 right now. That number again is 1-877-817-9829. Support small businesses and buy from the good guys at thepowermall.com. That's thepowermall.com.
Break the bond to Big Pharma. Hi, it's Joyce Riley with the Power Hour to tell you about the powerful benefits of Strauss Heart Drops. Many people today are locked into the routine of taking multiple prescription drugs. Strauss Herb Company believes that everything the body needs is provided by nature. Strauss Heart Drops may clear congested arteries, restore damaged muscle, maintain healthy cholesterol levels, and flush toxins and metals from the body. They may even be helpful in treating varicose veins. And unlike prescription drugs that are packed with chemicals, Strauss Heart Drops are 100% natural and harness the healing power of herbs like garlic, cayenne, white willow bark, and mistletoe. For the full line of Strauss products, I urge you to call the Power Hour at 877-817-9829. That's 877-817-9829. Or visit thepowermall.com. And remember, beware of knockoffs. Get the original. Get Strauss Heart Drops.
We've all heard about antibiotics, but what about probiotics? Antibiotic means against life. Probiotic means pro-life. Antibiotics kill bacteria that are infectious and harmful to the body. They also kill the good bacteria, though, that are necessary for good health. Probiotics from Living Streams replaces the healthy balance of friendly bacteria and normalizes the digestive tract. Gastritis, ulcers, diarrheal disease is just a few of the problems people develop when the intestinal flora is out of balance. Living Streams probiotics create the healthy balance needed for good digestion, suppresses growth of pathogenic bacteria, and actually increases resistance to infection. Call the Power Hour, 877-817-9829. Order your Living Stream probiotics today. They're available in 2, 4, and 8-ounce bottles, and Living Streams probiotics comes with a money-back guarantee. Get your body back in balance with Living Streams probiotics today. 877-817-9829. That's 877-817-9829. Living Streams Probiotics. Everyone should be pro-life.
Hi, this is Catherine at the Power Hour. The Power Mall began when Joyce Riley discovered an all-natural soap that heals skin issues and can replace your bathing, laundry, and household cleaning products. That soap is Miracle 2 and is made from natural minerals and coconut extract with no added fragrances or colors and is naturally concentrated and biodegradable. I guarantee after you discover how amazing Miracle 2 products are, you'll recommend them to everyone you know. To order, call 877-817-9829 or visit thepowermall.com today. You'll learn why so many people say, it's not just soap, it's a miracle.
With dozens of food storage companies buying up airtime all over radio, it's hard for you to know which company you can actually trust. Humana Food Storage is nutritious, is GMO-free, contains no aspartame, no high fructose corn syrup, has no chemicals, preservatives, or soy. And Humana Food Storage has a 25-year shelf life. Call Jay at 877-817-9829. That's 877-817-9829. Or order online at thepowermall.com.
America made good for you. Food stores all love to eat. Yum!
I'm always aghast about the lack of history being taught, the lack of variety of history. Even from when I was a child, I talked to my mother-in-law when she taught school, you know, all those years ago. She could see how things have changed. And if we don't know history, how do we know ourselves? How do we know where we come from? How do we know perspective? William Federer is one of the best out there, I think. Most interesting, most engaging. AmericanMinute.com. His website is fantastic. Every day, a little history blurb, a little something you probably didn't know, or if you knew about it, you know, in a different aspect of it. Just very fascinating if you're interested in history at all, or for your children, certainly very thought-provoking for them. AmericanMinute.com has written many books. The book that we're discussing is, it's a long title, I want to get it right, The Treacherous World of the 16th Century and How the Pilgrims Escaped. Very interesting title, of course, with Thanksgiving. We're giving some background how we got to Thanksgiving. We're talking about Squanto. But before we do, William mentioned impeachment. And since, you know, it's on everybody's mind, what's going on, give us a little bit of the historical precedence on what we're seeing on the impeachment. It seems unprecedented to me what's going on.
Right. Well, the basic thing we're experiencing is called psychological projection. Psychological projection. Sigmund Freud coined the term. He's a psychologist. It's where rude and hateful people call everyone they don't like rude and hateful. We've all met someone like that, right? And it's what little kids do. You know, I'm not the mean one. You're the mean one. You know, it's like you accuse your opponent of what you're guilty of. And so it's worked its way into politics. And so David Axelrod was the campaign manager for the previous president. And he said on NPR radio, April 2010, David Axelrod said, in Chicago politics, we have a tradition where you throw a brick through your own campaign office window and then call a press conference to accuse your opponent of having done it. Right. And so this idea of Karl Marx says, accuse others of what you do. And so it's worked its way in. So if there's a candidate that maybe is colluding with the Russians, giving away a fifth of the U.S. uranium in exchange for a $145 million contribution to her foundation, then she wants to accuse her opponent of colluding with the Russians. It's playing defense by playing offense. And then the opponent has to bend over backwards, show they're not guilty. And if it ever comes back around to you, by this time the water is muddied and the public doesn't know who is telling the truth, and you get a pass. And so if there's a candidate that's extorting the Ukrainians, saying, we're going to withhold U.S. money unless you drop the investigation of my son, well, then you want to accuse your opponent of calling the Ukrainians and threatening to withhold. You accuse them of exactly what you're doing wrong. And then the investigation process is designed to uncover and destroy all the evidence that can convict you. You destroy hard drives, laptops, emails, text messages, right? And so this is what we're experiencing. It's psychological. It's where so you'll have rude and hateful groups that will call nice, wholesome people rude and hateful because you're not embracing their agenda. And so they're the hateful ones. They'll even put up a website and they'll list everyone that they hate. And then the nice Christian people will just keep bending over backwards saying, no, really, I don't really. And you just keep backing up until they finally get you to bend over backwards and they get to pass their agenda. It's like a bully on a playground pushing everybody around. And if one kid stands up and a fight breaks out, the bully says to the teacher, he started it.
It's almost like at the end, you know, to continue with your analogy, you know, you keep backing up. No, I didn't do it. No, I didn't do it. They keep pushing. But finally at the end, they go, okay, I guess you didn't do it. Let's just forget about all this. let's just forget about talking about Russia or collusion or whatever. Let's just forget it.
Yeah. And then they get a pass for the crime that they did. And,
what about the impeachment itself? What about the technicality, the legal, I guess, procedure, for lack of a better word, the actual procedure of this quote unquote impeachment hearing seems very unusual to me. And it seems ridiculous, but it seems unusual, the procedures that are happening.
Right. Well, what the Democrats are doing is McCarthyism. Right? They're doing secret hearings against people that are innocent. But their goal is they don't have a candidate to run for president. New York Times, they don't have front page articles. I mean, we're a year away from the election. And the last election cycle, they had their candidates on the front page every day. They don't have any candidates. They're embarrassed of their candidates. If there is anything on, you know, Bernie Sanders or Warren or whatever, it's like on the back pages of the New York Times. They know they do not have a candidate. So the only alternative is to try to destroy your opponent's candidate. I ran for Congress 3 times. They do polling. There's 3 things, your name, ID, how many people have heard your name, and then your positives and your negatives. So, for example, if you run against a candidate, everybody knows his name. He has no room to increase his voter base. And then if his negatives are really high and everybody knows his name, they've already formed their opinions, it's really hard for him to switch it to make himself a positive in the people's eye. So what you're left with is destroying your opponent. And it's gotten to the place they call it politics of personal destruction. You want to not just defeat your candidate, you want to destroy their reputation, destroy their family. They have a person on the campaign staff whose job is called opposition research. All they do is try to dig up dirt on the opponent. Well, Nancy Pelosi put into place a House Ethics Committee the last time she was the speaker, and staff full of Democrat lawyers. All they do is full-time opposition research on all the sitting Republican congressmen. They're using the power of the intelligence community to dig up dirt. That's why you have 50, and it doesn't have to be anything you did wrong. It just has to be something that can appear wrong, and you don't have the time and money to clear your name. And so that's why you have 50 Republican congressmen say, okay, forget it. I'm not going to even seek re-election.
I mean, it seems like a third world dictatorship or a communist takeover. Am I delusional?
Right. So I wrote a book called Who is the King in America? And I mentioned it top down, bottom up. So for most of world's history, you have kings. I went back to the beginning of the invention of writing, Sumerian cuneiform on clay tablets in the Mesopotamian Valley. Today, that's Iraq. And the most common form of government is Nimrods, Pharaohs, Caesars, Kaisers, Sultans, Tsars. Power wants to concentrate into the hands of one person. And it's in the human DNA, goes back to the fall in the garden, Cain, kill, and Abel. So you put some babies in a playpen, one takes the rattle from the others. You put some kids on a playground, one's the bully, hogging the ball. You put some junior high girls in a clique, and one of them is the diva. You put some natives in the woods, one of them is the Indian chief. You put them in an inner city, one of them is a gang leader. And all a king is a glorified gang leader. It's a pyramid structure to society. If you are friends with the king, you are more equal. If you are not friends with the king, you are less equal. And if you're an enemy of the king, you're dead. It's called treason. Or you're a slave. And so it keeps repeating itself all around the world. I tell people, imagine if you were the king. That'd be pretty nice. And then you have a sister you really love. She has a kid. Now he's a teenager. He's hanging around the wrong type. He's drinking and partying. He hits someone with a car and kills him. And now he's facing manslaughter charges, mandatory prison time. And your sister comes begging to you and says, you're not going to let my little Johnny get locked away, are you? Wasn't his fault. Those other kids talked him into it, blah, blah, blah. What are you going to say to your sister? Well, I'll let little Johnny off the hook this time, but don't let it happen again. Guess what? As soon as you say that, you are the corrupt dictator. You just sent ripples through your kingdom that if you're family or friends of the king, you get special treatment. You're not family and friends, you don't get it. And if someone wants to point out your favoritism, you're going to be tempted to want to shut them up. And so it just happens. Power corrupts and absolute power corrupts, absolutely. So what's the opposite? Well, God comes down at the Tower of Babel and confuses the languages and the people scatter. So you see, I have people when I speak hold up a fist in one hand, say concentrated power, fingers apart with the other hand, say separated power, then back to the fist, concentrated power. That's world history. Most world history power is in the hands of the Caesars, Pharaohs, Tsars. Very rarely is it separated into the hands of the people. But in times of crises, people let go of their freedoms and the rubber band snaps back into the hands of the king. And so you actually have philosophers like Machiavelli and Hegel and Karl Marx and Saul Alinsky that talk about intentionally creating these domestic crises so that people will feel insecure, so they'll let the government usurp power and go back to the king. That's a whole another talk I do in a book called Rise of the Tyrant. But anyway, so you see that you mentioned gang style of behavior that's going on right now. What we're witnessing is the pivot point. It's like one of those, you know, things you sit on in a pool that's slippery and you're trying to stay on top, but all of a sudden it flips and you go under. It's like we're at this point where it's about to flip and we're barely hanging on to it. But it wants to flip back into the typical form of government, which is a gang style of government. It's a, if you're friends with the gang leader, you're more equal. You're not friends with the gang leader, you're less equal. You're an enemy of the gang leader, you're dead. Islam operates this way, right? If you're loyal and faithful to the ummah, the community, the group, you get emotional support. If you want to leave it, they'll threaten you and target you and even kill you. And so this dynamic, one of my talks, I give the difference between individual and group. Western civilization, Judeo-Christian values is summed up in one word, individual. You have rights because the creator gave them to you. And if there is no creator, well, then you get your rights from a group. And what the group gives, the group can take away. And that's when people, there's such a strong human desire to be accepted by a group. Little kids, you know, social community, social media, you know, Asia, they call it honor shame cultures where, and so,
Let me interject here because you said something that is very profound. I think that we're on a pivot point. I've been in a pool on that noodle or pool noodle or whatever, trying to balance and trying to, and slipping down. I can get that. What you're saying is we're at a crossroads. We're at a very delicate and dangerous point that this whole thing, the American experiment, what our founding fathers inherited or gave us as an inheritance, can basically go away really quickly if we don't pay attention here. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, yeah. If you can picture a spectrum of power. One side is total government. The other side is no government. Total government, you get a king. He rules through fear. You do what he says or he kills you. The no government side is anarchy. No government unless each person is taught the law. It's like everybody downloads a behavioral app for their iPhone. Instead of a GPS app telling you where to turn, it tells you how to act in real time. Don't steal that. Be nice to that person, right? Don't lose your temper. And the Levites in ancient Israel were the computer geeks that helped the Israelites to download this app, right? And I go to the Google Play App Store, you know, line upon line, precept upon precept, press this button here, right, install here. And so the Levites helped the Israelites to download this behavioral app. And so each citizen in Israel knew the law. But then the big question is, why would you follow it? What would motivate you to follow an internal moral? Well, you know, Israel had the key ingredient. There is a God who is watching everyone. He wants you to be fair, and he's going to hold you accountable in the future. So you're about to steal. Nobody's around. You know you can get away with it. And then you think, well, God is watching me. He wants me to be fair. He's going to hold me accountable in the future. Maybe I should hesitate stealing. Everybody in the country really believes this. Excuse me. You can maintain complete order with no police. And so that's what ancient Israel had. And that's what these pastors in New England set up for their congregational form of government. And that became the basis for our U.S. Constitution. So when we say it's one nation under God, it's more than just a nice acknowledgement. It's the acknowledgement of God, the fear of God, the awareness of God that motivates people to do the self-government.
Well, let me ask you this. I talked about this yesterday quite extensively. Our founding fathers, our framers, whatever you want to call them, they had a religion in mind for America. It wasn't going to be Protestant or whatever, but a general overarching morality and a basic, hey, there is a creator. We're responsible to the creator. Our soul's immortal. We're going to be judged, and we're responsible to each other. That's the basic religion of America. That's what I would argue. That's what I would say. And that was important. They knew that had to be taught. Morality had to be taught because that's the only way virtue could be exercised, because if you don't have virtue in your actions, then liberty becomes chaos. So virtue and liberty are inseparably connected and must be linked at all times. And our founders understood this exactly. Would you agree with that or disagree, or what's your comment on that?
Oh, a great insight. I view it as a teeter-totter. The more internal restraints the populace has, the less external restraints they need. Get rid of the internal restraints. People are going to give in to their passions and lusts. It's going to turn into chaos. And then everyone says, we need more external restraints. We need more policemen. We need more metal detectors. We need more, you know, take away our guns. You know, there needs to be more external controls. So either internal or external. I tell it's like a parent gives the teenager the car keys and says, look, you're a good kid. You can drive around and come home whenever, because I know you're going to do what's right. But if you don't do what's right, again, hang around the wrong kids, drink and drive, you're going to be pulled over by the police and controlled behind bars. So, teenager, you are going to be controlled either voluntarily from the inside or forcibly from the outside. It's the same way with a country. We're either going to be voluntarily controlled with internal morals, we're accountable to God, or we're going to teach the kids, give in to your passions and lusts. There's no right. There's no wrong. There's no absolutes. You can feel like a girl today, a boy tomorrow. You can kill the baby in the womb. There's no value for human life. You're an accident from evolution. So these kids decide, hey, you know, I decide I want to kill my classmate. Who can tell me it's wrong? And they do, and they kill it, and it turns into lawlessness and chaos. And then we say, government, you got to step in to restore order. And the government says, okay, we're going to take away your guns, take away your freedom of speech, so you can't say something that offends somebody, so they do something about it. And yeah, they'll restore order, but when the dust settles, you'll have transitioned from the people ruling themselves bottom up back to a king ruling from the top down.
Okay, what you just said, that is extremely profound, especially for where we are right now. What I take away, and I'm listening, if I'm sitting at home and we're looking at the public school system, the government school system, and they teach situational morality. They teach secular humanism. That is the religion of public schools. And the idea of taking away history, or history is situational also. So what was good, there are no eternal truths. What was good for the founding fathers isn't necessarily good for us. We need a new law, something new for the 21st century, a new morality. It's all situational. What you just told me is that by doing that, by allowing and handing over the minds of hearts and minds of our children over to that philosophy, you are guaranteeing chaos. You are guaranteeing the destruction of everything that is American. That's what you just told me.
Yeah, and it's not a new thing. Machiavelli talked about doing this. So 500 years ago, Italy was not Italy. It was a bunch of city-states, Venice, Genoa, Naples, Florence, Siena, and they all had armies and fought. And Machiavelli thought if one prince could control all of Italy, it would stop the infighting. So he writes a book called The Prince, where he advocates the ends justifies the means. The end of one prince controlling all of Italy is such a good end, because it'll stop this infighting, that any means necessary to get there is justified. Lie, cheat, steal. So if a prince wants to conquer a city, the people would hate him. But if the prince pays criminals to kill cows, burn barns, smash windows, set things on fire, the people will cry out for help. The prince will come in and kill the very criminals he bribed to create the crimes. No one would know the better for it, and everyone would praise the prince as a hero. So it's good marketing. You create the need and fill it. You go around the back of the house and set it on fire, and then you go around the front of the house and sell them a fire extinguisher, and they'll pay anything for it and even thank you for being there. So it's called Machiavellianism, where you create or capitalize on crisis to consolidate control. The British did this, right? They came into Bengal and India, and they would give guns to one kingdom, give guns to another kingdom, stir up ancient animosity so they'd fight each other, and then the British would come in to restore order and take away everybody's guns, and they'd conquer both. And then they would do it again and again and again till they took over India, a quarter of the world's population. It was controlled by, you know, by Britain. And they tried doing it in America. They would go to the American Indians and give them guns and incite them to scalp along our frontiers. But this idea was adopted by the KGB and, believe it or not, even the CIA. So Eisenhower, after World
well,
War
I believe
II,
it, William. Go
after
ahead.
World War II, Iran had a leader named Mossadegh, and he was leaning toward the Soviet Union. So Eisenhower approved the first CIA Operation Ajax to overthrow a country's leader. And our CIA guys go over there, find people with grievances, stir them up, arm them. It creates domestic crisis. And in the confusion, Mossadegh gets thrown out, and we help install the Shah. And the Shah loved America. But these concepts goes all the way back to Plato, where in you want to sow division, and then people feel insecure, and then they surrender their freedom. You know, I tell people, it goes back to the beginning of time, Cain was a tiller of the soil. So the first invention ever was a plow. And then people started hitting each other with it. They turned into weapons. And people felt insecure, so they would gravitate together for protection. And when you get people together, someone is a little better at knowing how to fight than the rest. And everyone says, you be our captain. And he organizes you, you fight, you win. That's a good thing. But then this captain has kids and grandkids who claim to be an elite class. My family is extra special, and it becomes this political machine in town, becomes a mob boss, a gang leader. He becomes a king. And everybody in the town has to kiss up to this guy. And if you don't, you're ostracized and kicked out. And so it's this, in times of insecurity, people surrender their freedoms. And so this is the thought of let's create insecurity. And so that's what this concept is. Anyway.
We got to met, but that's fascinating. One more segment on the other side.
We've all heard about antibiotics, but what about probiotics? Antibiotic means against life. Probiotic means pro-life. Antibiotics kill bacteria that are infectious and harmful to the body. They also kill the good bacteria, though, that are necessary for good health. Probiotics from Living Streams replaces the healthy balance of friendly bacteria and normalizes the digestive tract. Gastritis, ulcers, diarrheal disease is just a few of the problems people develop when the intestinal flora is out of balance. Living Streams probiotics create the healthy balance needed for good digestion, suppresses growth of pathogenic bacteria, and actually increases resistance to infection. Call the Power Hour, 877-817-9829. Order your Living Stream probiotics today. They're available in 2, 4, and 8-ounce bottles, and Living Streams probiotics comes with a money-back guarantee. Get your body back in balance with Living Streams probiotics today. 877-817-9829. That's 877-817-9829. Living Streams Probiotics. Everyone should be pro-life.
As you all know, everything begins with an idea. Ideas have helped shape the very world we live in. ThePowerMall.com began as an idea, allowing entrepreneurs and small business owners like yourself the opportunity to not only survive, but thrive in an era where corporations dominate. ThePowerMall.com is a small family-owned business who has partnered with companies you've come to rely on and trust over the years, like Strauss Heart Drops, North American Urban Spice, Miracle 2 Soaps, Vitamir, Numana Food Storage, to name just a few. Fight back against large corporations when you buy from thepowermall.com. Need to speak to a real person? Call Jay at thepowermall.com and receive superior customer service. Call 1-877-817-9829 right now. That number again is 1-877-817-9829. Support small businesses and buy from the good guys at thepowermall.com. That's thepowermall.com. Does Big Pharma have a hold of you? Thepowermall.com believes everything the body needs is provided by nature, unlike prescription drugs that aren't meant to cure but cover up your symptoms and contain addicting chemicals. Strauss Heart Drops are 100% all natural. Get the original. Get Strauss Heart Drops by calling Jay at 1-877-817-9829. That's 877-817-9829. Or order online at thepowermall.com today.